Dublin.
Welcome everyone to Studio Soundtracks, the monthly program that takes listeners behind the scenes of making music for film and television. I'm your host, Chandler Poling. On the program today, I am so happy to be featuring Theodore Shapiro. Welcome, Theodore.
Thank you so much for having me.
I always like to hear from the composer about their first time the bug bit them, like as far as when they knew that they wanted to be a composer or when they knew they wanted to write original music. And so I'm excited to feature you today on the program and hear, when did you decide that you wanted to be a composer?
I was I went to a liberal arts college, and I did not at that time think that I was going to be a composer professionally because my parents had always told me that I wouldn't do that professionally.
Oh.
And anyway, I got to school and I was, you know, early my freshman year, I tried rowing crew for a while. And it was just not really for me. So I stopped doing that. And that night, a friend of mine said, "Hey, I'm going to go audition for a play. Why don't you come with me?" And so I did. And I ended up getting cast in this play. And I just kind of got into the world of theater at Brown University. And so... you know, I had always been a pianist, a musician. I considered myself a composer, even though I hadn't actually done that much composing. But I just, started exploring just that world more of thinking of myself as a creative person, you know, and as thinking of that as something that I could do for my life's work. And that led to me doing a lot of writing for theater while I was there, eventually starting to write for film while I was there. And then, ultimately just decided that that life's too short not to try to do the thing that you love doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so funny. It's a little parallel story. Not that the show is about me, but I also was in college. I was a chemistry major, and I flipped into a theater and drama major,
Oh,
and I never looked back. And
yeah.
so,
There you go. You know what it's like.
yeah. So, what were your parents pushing you to do, if not compose?
I mean, they just thought that I would have a more stable profession. I think it was like, maybe you can do something that's like adjacent to a creative field. But once I made the decision to pursue it, they were very supportive. So
Oh,
I don't want to give them too much grief.
good. Great. You said that you didn't have much experience or that many credits when you were composing for film. But so, what was the first kind of original music you wrote? I imagine it's for a theater play or something like that.
I mean, I wrote some student pieces, some very rudimentary student pieces. In high school, mostly just piano pieces that I could play, and then a little bit in college. I wrote a musical my senior year of college, so that was a little bit more, that was a little bit more involved, compositionally. But it wasn't until I got to grad school that I really started kind of doing what I'd consider serious writing.
Yeah, so what the question that I was going to ask, it's so funny to know, like, when you're in school and you are trying all these different mediums and you're in doing theater, what is it, the discipline within the theater department or working on a play that you think you learned that is really unique to that atmosphere and yet you maybe carry on today?
I mean, I think that for the most part, the biggest thing about being in that world is just learning to think about narrative, talk about narrative, talk about, just how drama works and how different tones work. I learned just a lot from my fellow students about all of that stuff, in addition to my teachers. So it was just a great creative atmosphere, and people were just trying a lot of shit, and it was an exciting place to be. I really feel like a big part of being a film composer is just knowing how to be in the room with creative collaborators, and probably, my biggest foundation in having that sense of how to be in the room and communicate, is from college.
Oh, got it. Was there any creatives that you met in those days that you later
Oh
worked
yeah.
with?
Yeah. So, one of my best friends from college, and still one of my best friends, is John Hamburg, who went on to write and direct Along Came Polly, I Love You Man. He wrote screenplay for Meet the Parents and Zoolander. We're still working together. We're about to work together again, on Meet the Parents, the new Meet the Parents film. And so, that's a big branch of the tree of how I got my career started. I started doing his student films when he was at NYU grad school. That led to other NYU grad students seeing my work and asking me to write scores for their, student films. And then eventually an NYU student made a feature-length film that I scored that ended up going to Sundance and winning a bunch of awards that year. This was in like 97 or something. And so that was like my first real feature, and that was how things got started. And then I had another friend from college who he was part of this sketch comedy group that had a show on MTV in the late 90s called The State. And so there was an opening in the position for composer on that show, and so I was able to get that job despite having no experience at all, and I just kind of learned on the fly working on that. And that also had its own little branch of jobs that came from that in television. And Michael Showalter, who is my good friend who was part of that group, has gone on to have his own very successful career as a filmmaker. And he directed The Eyes of Tammy Faye, which I scored a couple of years ago. And
Yes.
I always tell people who are just starting out that relationships are the foundation of, of every career in this business. And that's 100% affirmed by my path. You know, I had these two friends, and of course other friends as well, but really the big trunks of the tree are those two friendships.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so fascinating to know that trajectory because it is important, like you said, those relationships, especially early on in those kind of early creative days where people are taking risks and trying things or making short films or whatever and just jumping in and doing it. I'm sure there was moments where you felt like you were submitting something that wasn't perfect and polished. How did you kind of get over your own mental blockades and being like, I'm just going to creatively jump into this and know that I'm going to get better over time?
It was just all I had, and at the time I thought it sounded okay, but it didn't. As the technology got better, as I was able to buy more and more stuff to make my stuff sound better, it just gradually became more and more closer and closer to professional, still striving for that.
Yeah, well, I feel like that's a mental hiccup that a lot of people have is that they don't even start because they feel like they can't hit perfection on the first go around. And there's that layer of revision and bettering yourself that people kind of, I think, miss out on or they psych themselves out too much on that they're not going to sound exactly what's in their head right now. So I'm always interested in how people overcome that mental blockade and they just go for it and at least, a lot of people have said this on the show, but you got to write something bad in order to write something good.
I think
And
that's right.
yeah, so I always encourage people just at least get something out there, even if you feel like it's not perfect, and then just grow from that. So you've scored numerous iconic films and television series. I'm going to list some of my favorites. I love 13 Going on 30, The Devil Wears Prada, Tropic Thunder, Jennifer's Body, Bombshell, which I played at the top of the show, a cue from Bombshell, and so many more. But it wasn't until Severance on Apple TV that you earned your first primetime Emmy win. And I was curious, what do you think it is about Severance that stands out in the television landscape these days?
I think that for starters, just the concept of the show is so powerful. It's such a powerful metaphor for so many things. It's just an instantly interesting idea. If I t tell you, in one sentence, it's about you go to a work at a place. It splits your you have a procedure done that splits your brain. When you go to work, you forget your home life. When you go home, you forget your work life. Like, if I just say that, I think it immediately draws you in to all of the possibilities and permutations of what could come from that setup. And I think that the show does a tremendous job of exploring those things, and just following that idea to all of the interesting places, or many of the interesting places where it can go. So it's a great concept that Dan came up with. And then, I think that Ben Stiller is such a remarkable director and producer, and has a unique ability to really see the entire breadth of the production. If you look at the show, in my opinion, the work that's done on the show across every department is so strong and unified, and that's a testament really to Ben and his, I think, very unusual ability to just kind of see everything. And he has an incredible filter for catching things that aren't right. And so I give him a ton of credit, and I and in terms of my process, I just trust him so much. And that's a wonderful feeling as a, as an artist of any kind, certainly as a composer, just to know that you can take chances and make mistakes and that he will encourage you to, to stay on the right path.
So on Severance, how did the score and the tone, and especially the main title theme, get determined? Was it immediate direction of like, this is the sound I want, or was it an experimental back and forth?
No, it was an experimental back and forth. What happened was, so Ben called me at in probably December of 2019, yes, about this idea, and I was very excited about it. I had actually heard about it from Adam Scott prior to that, who we know each other through our children. And I thought like, wow, what a great idea. I hope Ben calls me about this. And then he did. And so I said, well, my first thought is that maybe we should try something where there's one sonic world for the innies and then a different sonic world for the outies. And he said, yeah, that sounds like the right idea. And so I started writing a bunch of ideas and sending them off to Ben, and he was prepping. This is in early 2020. And then in late, I'm sorry, in March of 2020, or actually late February, right before the pandemic hit, he asked me to come out to New York. I went to the set. I saw, the plans for what they were building, and he showed me a lookbook of visual inspirations. And we just listened through to a lot of the stuff that I'd been doing. And I had written this one piece that was supposed to be for the innie world, which we had determined the innie world would be like very cold and electronic, and the outie world would be acoustic and warm and organic. And so he was listening through to all the stuff, and he was really positive about everything. But there was one part of this one piece that he kept kind of returning to. And it was built around these four chords. And I just noticed that he sort of kept listening to this one part. It was not even like the main idea of that suite. It was just the middle section that I, to be honest, kind of tossed off pretty quickly. And so I thought, well, I should explore that. Like Ben's instincts are great. Like there's something he's responding to in that. And then when I returned to Los Angeles from my trip, I sat down and I played those four chords at the piano. And I thought, oh, well, that's really interesting. Like those four chords at the piano have a really different tone. Like that feels like it feels, feels connected to 70s cinema and connected to mystery. It feels a little bit like the great David Shire score to The Conversation. And then just very quickly, like within, I don't know, a couple minutes, I wrote the melody. It just kind of happened quickly. And I sent this, I wrote another suite based on that and sent it off to Ben. And he did not respond for like 3 weeks. And so I thought like, bummer. Like I thought that that was something that had a lot of possibilities. And he obviously didn't like it. And then he called one day and was like, oh, this is great. I love this. Like, this is really exciting. This feels like the show. So that was really that was how it came to be. I had written this 2.5 minute version of it. And he asked me to condense it down to a shorter version that could work as a main title, and I did, and that was it.
Wow, and that main title obviously sets it up in with the visuals and everything in such a way with that show. How did you know he was listening to those four chords? Was it that he were you in the room and he kept rewinding to it, or
We were he was sitting in front of his laptop. Of course, as a composer, you love it when your work is being listened to on laptop speakers. And
That's irony, everybody, irony.
and he, like I had written at that point like I don't know 6 or 7 suites, And he just sort of kept on going. He kept on going back to that one, and not just that one, but sort of fast forwarding to the part where fast forwarding to the part where those four chords happen, and specifically to this part where it really like breaks out with a it had a breakbeat, and actually that material with the breakbeat is in the show at the end of episode 5 of season 1. If you're curious to know like what the particular part he was listening to at the time was, like it that it's there. And so yeah, so it was obvious, like he was clearly excited about that. And you know, the more I thought about those four chords, the more I thought like, oh, that's actually like pretty good chord progression. I should try to see what I can do with it.
Wonderful. Well, congrats on your current Emmy nomination. You've already won for this show. You're nominated again this year. So I'm wishing you the best of luck when the show comes up, the Creative Primetime Emmys. In the meantime, let's hear a piece from Severance that you brought. This is a piece titled Beast with Two Backs. What is it about this piece that you enjoy? Why did you pick this one in particular?
So a couple reasons. There's a new theme in season two for Mark and Helly and Helena, the sort of the triangle of those three. And I just really like that theme a lot. Like I it's it to me it's it captures the uncertainty of their relationship. And I just really like hearing it. It makes me happy. And so that's one part. And this piece climaxes. It occurs in the show in episode four of season two, while Mark and Helena are having sex in the tent during the Ortbo. Visually, I thought that the way that Jessica Lee Gagné, the cinematographer, shot that scene is just so spectacular. They're sort of lit by the red light of a heater in, and just the silhouette of the two of them having sex in this light, like it looks very kind of animal. And it's just so beautiful. And I just, when I was working on it, I just felt like, oh wow, this is, this is just a spectacular piece of film to get the privilege to work on. And the piece climaxes with a chord that I think of as the Irving chord, and it occurs throughout season two, at the climax of this cue, at the end of the episode of episode four, as Irving is being banished, or his life is being ended as an innie. I love this chord so much. I don't even really know how to parse it theoretically. It's a very dissonant chord, but it has a certain beauty to it. And I love it. And when I sent it off to Ben, he said, like, oh, that chord is my favorite thing that's happened in all of the music of this show.
Wow.
And so it's just one of those things where it's like, normally the thing that you're in love with as a composer is not the same thing that the director is in love with. And so it was just so gratifying to have this thing that was this weird dissonant chord that I loved so much, and have Ben respond by saying, like, oh, this is the best. And it was a good feeling to be so in sync with him.
Fantastic. Well, the range of music that you brought to the program for today is truly exciting. It's so varied. And my favorite piece actually is from Destroyer, which I'm going to play at the end of the show so that all the listeners can make sure that they stay all the way to the end for Destroyer. But yeah, does writing in different genres of music excite you or terrify you?
Oh, it excites me. Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, for me, staying in one place is just hard, because if you've already done it, then it becomes harder to find new ways to say something similar. And I don't know, I like the artists that I admire, the directors that I admire most are curious people who try a lot of different things on, and so I that's what I enjoy doing as a composer, is just trying a lot of different things and being able to experiment and challenge myself to do things I haven't done before.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things about composers is that, some of them have a style that they stick in, and obviously you are doing all types of different genres. However, with another track of yours, it's a piece from Trumbo. It's a film starring Bryan Cranston from 2015. And this one, I was listening to all the tracks he submitted. This one almost feels in line with Severance, like it could go into Severance in a way. And I wanted to play them kind of side by side so people can kind of hear if there's a little audio signature of Theodore Shapiro that we can pull a thread and everything. So let's listen to the track and then we can talk about it.
Thank you.
So that track, which is titled 80 Words a Minute, talk to me about this track and the score to Trumbo. Are we uncovering a preferred style of your writing?
Wow. Well, I don't like to like shine a light on it. I like to keep it a mystery to myself. I would say that this piece, or the material for this piece, came before or during the time when Jay Roach was shooting Trumbo. So I was working, having seen not very much of the movie at all. And so that's a way that I like to work, that lets me just explore music on the basis of theme and character and sort of working off the script more than the picture. And so I had seen a rough cut of just a scene of Trumbo typing at the keyboard, and there was something in it that made me think of a prepared piano. And so I just thought like that could be an interesting sound to explore. And I just sat down and started, I came up with that prepared piano. It's not a loop. It was just me sort of improvising and playing in this rhythmic way, and just sort of letting it be a percussion instrument. And it felt really exciting. Like I thought that that was the idea of like putting these kind of Gil Evans-y, brass and wind chords and string chords on top of that rhythmic bed. Just felt like a really exciting, interesting idea, and luckily, Jay responded to it, and so it made it into the movie, but I was able to use that material for the end credits, and that's where 80 Words a Minute is used in the end credits, and it's the place where that material really gets to come to full fruition, and as part of it. We let the great, great musicians, Randy Kerber, the pianist, and Mike Valerio, the bass player, have a lot of space to improvise. So I set up, I set up a structure, for the orchestra, and then they just had free rein to do these improvisations. And, it was really one of the most thrilling things that I've ever recorded. They're such brilliant musicians, and they just played so amazingly well and listened to each other, and I just find it so exciting to listen to that piece.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great piece. Is there a style or a genre of music that you just prefer to listen to in your own casual time?
I'd say usually if I'm listening to music, it's generally like in the indie space. That's usually what I'm listening to. Yeah, I like sort of slightly weird indie music.
Yeah, awesome. We are coming upon the 20th anniversary of The Devil Wears Prada. I can't believe we're almost there. And, the nostalgia engine is starting to hit the greater public. I've seen more social media posts. I've seen artist tributes. I've seen drag performances more than ever on this particular movie. I wanted to know what it was like working on this film, and did you have a sense that it was going to become a cult classic?
I knew the movie was really good. Like I didn't think I did not think at all a cult classic. And honestly, like I wasn't even that confident that it was going to be a hit, because you really never know.
True.
And to be honest, like what I remember, I don't remember the details, but like I don't even think it was the number one movie the week it opened. There, it opened
Yeah.
against a big blockbuster, but it was clear from the response to the film that it was really working. That David Frankel, who's the director and who I adore, great guy, like he often will say he didn't say this about Prada, but he said this about another movie that he had made. You're like, it does its job. And so like I felt like Prada did its job in a really great way. And you know, I knew and I knew from seeing an audience's response to it, like I just knew it worked.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's hear this suite that you brought from The Devil Wears Prada. Have you ever rewatched any of the films you've worked on? I imagine you were watching them all the time when you're working on them. Maybe you watch it at the premiere, but do you ever go back and watch movies you've worked on?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I would never choose it for myself. I've
Right.
watched a bunch with my kids.
Yeah.
We've watched Spy like so many times together. And yeah, I mean, I used to really hate watching my work because as soon as it was over, I would only kind of hear the mistakes that I made or the things that, like, oh, I could have done that. I could have done that. But with the passage of time, you know, if I get a decent distance away from a movie, I'm finding myself more and more able to watch it and appreciate the work that I did.
Yeah, I can imagine, and I'm sure most artists feel that way about, you know, once the work is done and out of the system, we don't need to revisit it. But movies are such an interesting medium, and especially the sharing aspect, like you said, to share it with somebody who has not seen it is always an interesting kind of function. On The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, I know that in the, you know, there is a community of soundtrack and film music lovers, and people loved this. You actually won an International Film Music Critic Award for this score. What is it about Secret Life of Walter Mitty, as a project that kind of stands out for you?
That was a wonderful experience. I mean, you know, I thought that felt like a beginning of Ben Stiller's transformation as a director. You know, he when we did Tropic Thunder, Ben was, you know, which is a great, great movie. You know, Ben was really like focused on being maximalist. You know, like tons of energy and ton, you know, just everything like very, very punchy. And it's great. And with Mitty, you know, he's just moving into a very different headspace as a director. Like it's so beautiful. And you know, and he is sort of less in a hurry, I think, as a director, which, you know, a trajectory that I think that you see sort of furthered in his work on Dannemora and Severance. And I had such a great experience working on this film, working with Jose Gonzalez, the amazing artist, was a great experience. He is a great person. You know, if you're familiar with his music, like the type of person that he is in sync with the type of music that he makes. He's just a wonderful soul. And you know, and this piece, Stationary Cycle, that I sent you, that was really like the breakthrough moment with that score, where when Ben was in production, I sent him these three thematic ideas, and I had two that I thought were pretty good, and I just thought, ah, rule of threes, I'll do one more, and I sent him that one, that's in Stationary Cycle, thinking, oh, well, he's probably not going to go for this because it's too lyrical and too pretty. But that was the one that he latched onto, and yeah, and I it was a great harbinger of just sort of what that whole process was like, and the way that he was in sync with this sort of very lyrical and beautiful approach to the music.
Wonderful. Well, let's listen to that. This is called Stationary Cycle from The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. Well, this has been really fun getting to know you and chat with you and everything. I have a last question for you that I ask of all my guests. And that question is, what was the first album you purchased and what was the last thing you listened to?
The first album that I purchased, I'm not positive, but I think it might be Vacation by the Go-Go's.
Okay.
I know for sure that that was the first concert I attended. I think that might have been the first album that I bought.
That's fun.
And yeah, super fun. And the last thing I listened to was the new album by the artist Dijon, Baby. And he's a really interesting artist and clearly influenced by Prince, a favorite of mine, and that was really cool.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again for joining me on the show. Everybody that is listening, we are Studio Soundtracks only on Dublab Radio. Listeners can find the soundtracks of all of Theodore's work on your streaming platform of choice, and I'm sure you can find some on CD and collectible as well. So go out and get those. And of course, go watch Severance on Apple TV if you haven't seen it yet. It's a fantastic show. Our outro music, as promised, is going to be my favorite track of Theodore's that he brought to the show. It's called Ecstasy from the film Destroyer. Thanks again so much for joining me on Studio Soundtracks.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really fun.